Welcome to the To Read List. I'm Bailey, and this is a podcast where I attempt to get through the 126 unread books on my shelf. With me is my brother, Andrew.
Hello.
And my husband, Dylan's the sound recordist.
Hello.
You might notice we're missing someone.
We kicked him out. We didn't kick you out.
Toby, no, we miss you. Toby is in England with his wife. I don't know, doing English things?
I think he's being chased by the ghost of Jane Austen.
I think he's hanging out with Paddington Bear, maybe Sherlock Holmes.
He's doing a buddy comedy with, I wanted to say Rolf the Muppet, but Rolf the Muppet's not British at all.
Nope.
His mother's British, actually, and he just naturalized his accent.
The other context you should know is that Andrew is here with us.
Yay!
In Los Angeles.
I'm in person.
Yay.
I can see what they look like when they say they're nasty goof-em-ups.
Uh-oh, and he's wearing the shirt I got him that says, "What excellent boiled potatoes."
With a picture of Mr. Collins from the 2005 Pride and Prejudice.
It's perfect in every way. And we didn't sleep very much, so we're a little loopy, which will make for a fun podcast.
Bum, bum, bow. That was an appropriate time to do a DJ drop, right?
Of course. We are also recording in a very special place. Dylan, do you want to describe the room that we're in?
We're kind of in a haunted house that's been haunted by the ghosts of elks that have come before us.
And by elks, you don't mean the animal.
Well, there is a big elk head over there.
It's true.
There's a lot of elk memorabilia from the National Society of Elks, the secret organization.
For men only.
For men only.
We're recording in Dylan's parents' house, which was built in 1911, and it has this giant attic that has been decorated. Like, first of all, the house, you know, it's got a bit of a creepy vibe. It's got a bit of a haunted vibe, let's be honest.
Yeah, so this house, as somebody walking down the street asked us, was made in 1911,
mm-hmm.
which is young by English standards, but really old by LA standards.
It's true.
And it was made by the former West Coast head of the Elk Society.
Elk Society being the secret society that we described. And there are several floors. This third floor is a creepy attic that is decorated like it's a lodge for the elks, like they would have had their secret meetings here.
Yeah.
And it's covered with taxidermy and pictures of men all lined up and staring straight ahead.
And then like semi-clothed women with elk heads.
Yeah. 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 So anyway, that's where we're recording. So if
there's a voice just whispering in the background of this entire episode, it's a ghost of one of those men.
If he's just going, elk.
What sound does an elk make?
Wah!
If you hear that, then you'll know. But we're here.
But we're here. We're doing it. We're talking about books. Speaking of, Andrew, do you have any shame? Because I don't have any shame.
Wow, just throwing it right at me like a punk.
I'm just feeling very proud
like
that I have
no shame.
Like a
punk rock prom queen, brown paper magazine.
Hotter than you ever seen.
I don't remember the next line. Anywho, so yes, I do have one itty bitty little bitty bit of shame. I purchased, as I sort of implied that I might, the next book in the Devabad trilogy, which is called The Kingdom of Copper, which we covered on a couple episodes ago by S.E. Chakraborty. So that is on the list. We'll put it in. My idea is to read that during summer reading time. So you probably won't get to hear my thoughts on it, punks.
Summer reading time. Describe what is summer reading time?
Well, you know, if I go on like a lake trip, I feel like it'll be like candy book.
So that way you'll have something to talk about with your other classmates when you go back to school in the summer?
Yeah, I have to take notes on it. No, I just mean like a beach read.
I get you. I was picturing when you are cool and in the summer go to the library and get points for every book you read during the summertime.
Yeah, you should be at the club.
The club. I've been moving books, and that, again, puts into perspective how many books I have. And so I think I've gotten rid of maybe three.
Yeah, and for context, Bailey, you still did say 126 at the beginning of this episode, which
yes.
is one more than we started.
I'm doing great.
Just wanted to, like, when we're dunking on my shame, just point that out one more time.
I did start at 125. We are, what, 6 years in? 5 years in? Who knows? What is time? But we're here. We're recording. And I'm wondering, Andrew, did you read a book this week?
I did. I read quite a book this week.
Ooh.
I read The Unwomanly Face of War by Svetlana Alexievich.
Unwomanly.
Just the one.
That's it.
I'm every unwoman.
It's all in war.
Okay, so it's about World War II. So yeah, this book is quite a tome. So here's a little intro amuse-bouche about this horrors of war.
Fun.
Yeah. The unwomanly face of war, Svetlana Alexievich's intimately and intricately compiled oral history, tells stories long relegated to the sidelines, that of female Soviet military personnel. Born out of thousands of hours of interviews with surviving women, the book charts rigorous enthusiasm, untold horrors, disillusionment, and both a future and a past that isn't as cut and dry as One Side Won and One Side Lost.
Did you write that this morning?
Yes.
Okay. Again, for context, because I've been around you, you finished this like a few hours ago and you wrote this very lovely paragraph.
Wow. Just blowing up my spot. Pedros, I always finish my book with plenty of time to digest and think about it.
I'm more giving you a compliment because you can write so well in such a short amount of time.
Oh, thank you.
So take it. Take that compliment.
All right. I have taken it.
Okay.
So yeah. So for a little more context about how this book came to be, Svetlana Alexievich is a Belarusian author and she spent a very, very long time interviewing thousands of people who served on the Soviet side of World War II, specifically the women who did that. If you don't know for context, the Soviet Army was a lot more welcoming to women, specifically as frontline fighters and being more involved in like the actual combat than a lot of the other Allied forces were. And I think even the Axis forces. I think it was a pretty unique scenario at that time.
Because of communism?
That is sort of a theory. It's also that they were wildly unorganized to start the war and just needed to throw anybody who was willing to go, and a lot of women were willing to go.
They already lost it from three wars in a row right before it. They lost a lot of men.
So yeah, like the story, the like romanticized story is it's like, it's because of communism, everyone's equal. The more reality side of it is they needed people.
ran out of men and boys.
Yes. So what she did is she interviewed all these people. She compiled, she keeps referencing it in it, like thousands of yards of tape recordings. And then she compiled it into this sort of nifty is the wrong word, like slim volume. It's only around 330 pages of the actual thing. There's like a very large intro, but the actual like text of it is only just over 300 pages that just charts the war from a bunch of different angles. It vaguely follows a chronology from the top to the end, but it like dips in and out because that's sort of how it goes. So that's what the book is.
Is it just like primary source with the interviews, or is she like she writing like a narrative version in between?
Bailey, that's a phenomenal question. She does intersperse her own thoughts in it. They're always in italics. Anytime it's her speaking, she writes in italics. And each like chapter will have an intro that varies as being a very short paragraph or like up to a few pages that like sets the scene. And it does actually sort of chart her, like she started this very enthusiastically and then sort of gets worn down by like how awful some of the stories are. Mm. And like by the end, she's like putting in just like one sentence and is like, and I kept going.
It's very similar to the Mitfords that I had to read, except instead of, well, it, because it had the intro to each chapter and then it had the primary sources, but instead of having the like one sentence, you know, interjections, she just had very extensive and annoying footnotes. I mean, footnotes.
Yeah, but I will say maybe one thing that does like distinguish it from that is, and maybe makes it a little more engaging, I don't want to talk about her experience with Mitfords in terms of that, is that the people who are talking directly to her and telling her the story and wanting to impart it to the author, not like just writing to their sister and then later it's recorded.
Okay, just blow up my spots, fine.
Well, I mean, they are different styles of writing.
You write.
Because they're not, the women are the primary source. What's written down isn't quite the primary source. Do you know what I mean?
Because
they're remembering it from years and years past. So it's hard to like talk more about the plot of the book because the plot is World War II, specifically the Eastern Front. So learn about
that. What's World War II? Just kidding.
So if you want to learn more about that, I suggest there's many good places. You could listen to Ghosts of the Ostfront by Dan Carlin.
Stop ruining my facts about World War II.
You could take U.S. history.
Well, no, actually, there's not that much about the Eastern Front. Honestly, one of the first places I learned about it was Hardcore History's series that goes to the Ostfront. The crazy stuff that happened on that side of the war is not told that often.
I was this many years old when I realized that there was an Eastern Front, and that's why All Quiet on the Western Front is that.
So feel bad.
I remember the first time I heard of this book was from Twitter when EA made a video game Battlefield and the lead was a Russian woman soldier. And of course it went as well as you thought of a lot of Twitter people saying, it's like, women didn't fight in World War II. And then someone commented, it's like, actually, according to Unwomanly Faces of the Front, and he quoted the whole thing. I thought, okay, good. I was going to agree that it's like women fought on the Eastern Front, but I don't know enough about Eastern Front to 100% say that for certain.
So then what was Japan, not the Eastern Front?
Pacific Theater. Bailey, become a father. And you will learn all these. The moment you become a father, all of these facts pop into your head.
That's how it works, okay.
Andrew, how often do you think of the Eastern Front?
Often. I'm actually not going to lie to you, often. Not as often as I think about the Roman Empire. to go back to 6 months ago. Anywho, this is a sort of tough book to review because I can't like dig into plot and things that I liked or didn't like because, of course, I didn't like war atrocities. But I liked...
Why?
But I enjoyed learning about them, and the women who were telling them were really compelling. So like, if we're going into Orcs and Elves, which again will be a pretty... This will be a pretty short review because it is just sort of what it is.
My orc is war.
Yeah. My orc is the act of war. My elf is the book as a work of recorded history, and my elf is like these women telling their story, and like I don't know how to get like more specific with what my elves are about this book other than like it is good that this book exists. It was did not exist until the author undertook a many many years long project of getting these stories, recording them, and like periodically throughout the book people are like, oh, like the women will say like, oh god, thanks for finally talking to us, like no one's asked us about this in years. Like, and it's also really complicated, I should say, by the fact that right after World War II, the Soviet Union was like, we won, nothing bad happened, we did nothing bad. You go to the gulag because you suggested that maybe this isn't just a perfect victory. So like a lot of these women were actually silenced by government and not just by like not wanting to talk about it, because she tried to write this book, and she says this in the intro, and she did write it, and like things got censored because they were like, we're not supposed to talk about how bad this was, we won, it's like a moment of greatness in our history, cut that from the book.
Ignorant question, like when they say about how bad it got, what does that mean? Is it specific to women or just in general? Well,
it's mostly in general. So like it's things like, well, there are certain things like incredibly horrible things happen to women on the front.
Is it like in the past, like with Napoleon, it's like it was very cold in Russia.
So yeah, it's like there were, I think a lot of it honestly has to do with how ill prepared the Russian army was. And it didn't reflect well. Like the casualties they suffered was a lot to do with their disorganization versus a lot of people didn't need to die that died. Like there are sections where they're like, and when they first went there, you know, half the people didn't have guns. They waited to see if someone died so they could grab a gun from a corpse and then they would have a gun for the battle. Like that.
Okay.
And guys, Enemy at the Gates is such a good movie.
I haven't seen this movie.
No, in that movie they do that.
They talk about that.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So like that's sort of the main thing. And then like also if you were a prisoner and survived, they were like, well, you must have survived by collaborating. So you go to prison camp.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so the book that we have here is a translation, like a first English translation. It came out in like 2004-ish, I want to say. But it's like the first English translation of the work, and it came after the fall of the Soviet Union. So she has put back in all the stuff that they forced to cut,
yeah,
and references it.
I was going to say to give you a smidgen of my facts, but do you want to talk about when this was written?
Let's just save it because I really think that I'm going to put a button on my review like now, which is just the only work that I have is like some of the stories get a little repetitive.
How dare you?
But that is because
women.
that is because what happened to the people in
how
this book.
Are you saying that
you?
War never changes? Guys, I'm getting all my great video game quotes out here, and this is not helping.
No, I don't play war video games, so I don't know any of these references. So if that's my only orc, that's not a fair orc. This book, it would be disrespectful to give it anything other than 5 stars because of the work that was put into it and the stories that are inside it. If it's not your cup of tea, that's fine. But like as a work of history, it's like a necessary and vital piece. So I'm going to give it 5 stars. I think there's not much more to say about specific likes and dislikes about it, and I'm very fascinated to learn about the author. So, Dylan.
Well, I just want to say it sounds... Sounds like, first of all, like on the surface, this is an incredible premise and setup for a book, and it seems like she really pulls it off, that the interviews are really strong and that she arranges it in a really good way.
Yeah, and she is like a very like smart cutter of things. Things do not really drag on. There's very few sections that are, you feel like, oh, you could have thinned that one down.
Are there pictures?
No.
Okay, now Dylan, do you have any facts?
Yes. Well, first let's talk about World War II.
Are you trying to be Dan?
Could you imagine just being a woman on the Eastern Front?
This is a very specific reference, but we all get it.
Okay, oh, actually, guys. One orc. They didn't talk about the Noctexan, which was a specific squadron of female pilots.
Yes.
I think I've seen a picture of that, and they look really badass.
Yeah. There was one. There were a few pilots referenced, but they didn't specifically talk about that, and I went into this book hoping I would learn about them. So sorry. One orc. Take that, Alexievich.
So let's see, who wants some fun Svetlana Alexievich facts?
Spoiler alert, I know they're not going to be fun.
They're not going to be fun. Basically, she was born in the West Ukrainian town of Stanislav in 1948, and then things got worse.
Whew.
You also have to understand the context that she is apparently the most famous Belarusians in her country, and that's pretty much the only reason that she's been allowed to kind of write these books.
Uh-huh.
She's their J.K. Rowling. Bad example. She's their Stephen King.
Okay.
She started off as a reporter. It's very fascinating. I hope she does an autobiography someday, because she started as a reporter at Belarusian State University and became a correspondent for the literary magazine Yomen in Minsk. And a huge thing throughout her life is that she was a journalist in the Soviet system.
Okay.
So she grew up in the Cold War. When she studied journalism at the University of Minsk, students had to ask permission to read Nietzsche and Freud or any like philosophy textbooks, and her requests were always denied. So then she started writing essays from people that actually survived the event she was studying, including war stories told by her grandmother, a veteran of World War II.
Don't want me to read Freud? Fine, I'll talk to women.
Great. She became a reporter, but then after getting a bunch of stories rejected, she started interviewing people using the excuse for Victory Day funds. Basically, she told the Russian government, it's like, we need to get all these soldiers brave stories, and she didn't tell them that she was going to be focusing on women and women's stories.
What's a Victory Day fund?
Victory Day, and it's still celebrated today, is in May, and it's their kind of like 4th of July, the Russia's 4th of July.
Okay.
So this was part of what Andrew was talking about, that like in the 80s especially, they were very pro-Russian towards the end of the Soviet Union. So she kind of rode that wave to make this book. It was serialized in October, a Soviet monthly literary magazine. So she republished these stories as kind of like a running thing. And then in 1985, the book came out. The book was heavily censored. So
1985. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. So that's why I was wondering that like what version he got it, because this book came out, there is like... If you look at it, there's literally, I'm showing them the list. These are different editions.
There looks to be about 20 different versions on that Wikipedia list.
Yeah, there's like 20 different versions of it. And there's English one, there's Russian English one. There's like a bunch of different ones. And so more stories kept adding on and getting taken away from it.
Seems like you read the right one, though. Not the right one, but most interesting one.
This one is like considered sort of the definitive English version now.
Yeah, because she was also involved in these republishings of like all her books that like she will... Imagine if you wrote a book and you had to keep rewriting the book throughout the rest of your life.
I can imagine.
But then she decided to start writing a follow-up book for it called Zinky Boys. Called Zinky Boys or Zinc Coffins in Russian. And it's about the fallen soldiers of the Soviet-Afghan War. Because they were returned home in zinc coffins. And that book was not met well. And so the government really came down on her for desecrating the soldier's honor. However, she published this in 1989, and she got, not lucky, but history was on her side that they had bigger fish to fry than her. So she was kind of in Russia at the time. This is when she moved to Belarus and became more Belarusian author, but she was able to escape.
And what was her next book, Dylan? Did she play it safe after that?
Was it like We Love Movies?
Then she wrote a rom-com based on the Eastern Front of a woman falling in love. No, she wrote Voices of Chernobyl in 1995, where she talked to survivors of Chernobyl, and spoiler alert, she's not pro.
She's not pro Chernobyl.
Side. It, besides the show actually, Craig Mazin repeatedly calls out her book as like one of the most important things.
I was going to say, I feel like I heard him talk about reading that book.
Yeah, he says like a lot of scenes in that HBO show Chernobyl are based off of stuff she wrote.
That tracks because the show too follows like lots of different people's experience in different...
Yeah. Okay. One really harrowing thing is that she talks about how one of the first editions she made was kind of like more anonymous because some of the people were living in like Ukraine or some of the people were living in Russia. So she took out some of the names of like the actual people, and some of the women of the firefighters who died in Chernobyl said like, you have to put our names back in because we told you this. We want their names to be remembered.
So she was trying to protect them and they're like, no, we're being...
Yeah.
Cool.
Guys, on the meanwhile, she also wrote Enchanted by Death.
Is that like a sequel to Enchanted?
Is it Ella Enchanted?
But she also wrote kind of another huge textbook, Secondhand Time, The Last of the Soviets, which is kind of about the fall of the Soviet Union, both politically wise, but also like what was going on in the country. How did the upper class feel? How did the lower class feel? I don't know how much time she has to do all these interviews. It seems that she interviews just everyone. And because of all this work, in 2015, she was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. She's the first and I think still the only journalist to win it.
Cool.
And she is also now very, she says she's not really a journalist anymore. She's like a narrative story collector or something. She keeps changing that. But she makes it very clear that she does not really write for newspapers anymore.
I just keep thinking about like, she and Krakauer have a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
In terms of the kinds of books. I mean, like, obviously hers are more serious, but.
Well.
Mine's cooler.
Okay.
John Krakauer gets to hang out with Sean Penn all day, though. Svetlana's been having a lot of fun the past few years.
Has she? Hashu Dylan.
Because really fast, non-political talk. Belarus is not really a great country when it comes to freedom of speech because it's kind of run by a dictator.
It's a direct sort of subservient state to Russia, yeah. Led by a strongman dictator who follows Putin's instructions.
So she has basically been in and out of exile from Belarus for the past like 20 years. In 2011, she was literally chased out of the country. Apparently there's an interview with her where you can hear like people kind of knocking on her door.
Oh my gosh.
And she says like, I'm currently recording right now. And so they leave. There is a really good article called Svetlana Alexievich is Not Going Anywhere by Masha Gessen in 2020. So right before this was all happening, she thought Lukashenko was her biggest problem. And there's a crackdown, because I don't know if you guys remember, in 2020, the biggest news that was happening was the Belarus uprising.
Yeah, nothing else happened that year.
But when it was happening, they basically started cracking down on anyone that could be involved in leading it, including the coordinating councils, which was basically the art council that she was in charge of. And on Tuesday, Alexievich realized that she was the last member of the council who remained free in Belarus.
Oh my gosh.
Everyone else was arrested. And she decided to run to the countryside and then changed her mind about that. Oh, after she said she was in the countryside, because I realized, and this is a quote from her, I realized it was no longer possible for me to stay in the countryside because it was easy for me to be arrested or disappear without anyone noticing.
Oh, yeah.
So she left in 2020, promising to return. She returned in secret in 2021 for a little bit to do some more work on a project she's working on. And then she's left currently because obviously she is very against the war in Ukraine. She, if you remember from the beginning, is part Ukrainian.
Right.
And when she was in Belarus, she was kind of trying to focus more on Belarus. And recently, as up to 2023, she's now been very outspoken against it because she's now in Germany. This is also one of the hardest authors I've had to find personal fun facts. Like, where do you write? Because she literally says, I hide secrets about my family because I don't want them in danger's way.
Yeah, where do you write? Wherever I can when I have a moment when I'm not being chased.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's her. And she is still currently writing it. She's working on some... Basically, they think she's working on a book about the Ukrainian war or Belarusian uprising. So she is currently... interviewing people.
Wow.
All right.
But that's Svetlana Alexievich.
Those are some harrowing facts. Good job. Facts.
Yeah.
I do kind of want to read at least this book or the Chernobyl book, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently, she doesn't give a lot of interviews because she says she has not really cared about learning English. So a lot of her interviews have to be done in Russian.
Love it.
And she also suffers from trigeminal neurologica. Basically, she has like a painful face condition.
Oh.
So when she's interviewing people, she has to watch out for that.
She seems like a very brave lady, and I admire her and want her to be my friend, even though I don't speak Russian.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, that was really good. I'm really glad we covered it. Great facts, Dylan. I think we need a little palate cleanser. Bailey, did you read a book this week?
Yeah, I read a really fun rom-com.
Certainly wasn't about like murder in a hyper-religious community or anything.
Certainly not. I read Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer.
Oh, no.
Oh, wait, sorry. I should get the subtitle. Under the Banner of Heaven, A Story of Violent Faith. We have covered John Krakauer before. I want to say 2019, 2020.
I was going to mention we have covered it on the January 12th episode of 2021 with Girl, Woman, Other. So if you want to check out Girl, Woman, Thin Air.
Yes, Into Thin Air, which was a 5-star book for me. I really enjoyed it. And when I was a teacher, I used to teach Into the Wild. So I have, you know, I enjoy John Krakauer and I was looking forward to reading this book. I've had this book for a fair amount of time and I had been excited for it to be pulled because I'm the kind of person that didn't want to watch the show with Andrew Garfield until I read the book, even though several people, I think all three of you, including Toby, were like, you don't have to do that. That's not what the book is. And you were right. And I had to experience that for myself. The book is about Mormonism, a sect of religion that was founded within the last 150 years in America, which is very different from a lot of other religions. But for those of you who have seen the Book of Mormon or...
That's your go-to there?
Well, I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of wild stuff in there.
Yeah.
With that said, like, you could say there's a lot of wild stuff in a lot of religions, but it's just the fact that this is pretty recent that people are like, I don't know about that. Ooh, I'm going to get some enemies there. So, like, let's say that 75% of the book is about the history of Mormonism. The other 25% is about a true crime story involving two excommunicated Mormon men who viciously murdered a woman and her baby girl. So it's about that story. And my understanding is the show is more about that true crime story versus the whole history.
Like, there's an Andrew Garfield detective character who is also Mormon going through a crisis of faith. But, like, I think there's a detective in the book, but it's not really,
this is kind of, I don't know if it's an orc or what, but like, it's not a mystery. It's there's no investigation. Like, they know who did it. The guy's very much like, they kind of proclaim it as a good thing. Like, they were like, God told me to do it, so I did it. And so it's more of like the trial. It's kind of like in Cold Blood that it takes a while to get to the description of the crimes, which are horrifying, obviously. So that's in there. But in general, it's not so much a mystery as like using this framework of this horrible murder to sort of explain how Mormonism could lead to that in terms of like men being in charge, men, you know, being unchecked, this feeling of grandeur, et cetera, et cetera.
And it's worth underlining that the people who did the crime, again, are like extreme to the point of being excommunicated from the version of Mormon faith that, you know, has its headquarters in Salt Lake City, etc.
Yes. And they do talk about how there are several sects of Mormonism, like, and this, they were from a particularly extreme one and they were excommunicated from that. And they were very clearly mentally ill as well. So like, it's not meant to be a critique of Mormonism as a whole.
Right. Just wanted to throw that out there so it doesn't seem like we're dunking on a religion.
Right. And honestly, I think that that's one of the things that Krakauer is trying to express too. Like, some criticism has been like, this is just anti-Mormon. He's like a, what's the word? Agnostic person, like that he just wants to slam our religion. I do not think that's the case. And that's not the impression I got from the book, but I could understand if you're from the LDS church that you might think that.
I remember reading this book and thinking that like, oh, this is like a subsect of Mormonism, but they do really cover the whole Mormon faith.
Yeah.
So that's like, oh, this is what the subsect believes. Like, no, there's parts of this. It was like, all Mormons believe this part.
Okay. So this is all connecting to my review, which is that the book came out, I think, before a lot of non-Mormon people were familiar with that kind of stuff, which, you know, again, if you've seen the Book of Mormon, if you know more about it, there's documentaries too. I've seen like Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey that brings it up too, where you're like, hold on. They think what? You know, they think the Garden of Eden is in Jackson County, Missouri. They think XYZ. They think, you know, that this man, Joseph Smith, found these golden tablets from the angel Moroni that told him XYZ. So like, if you were reading this for the first time in this book, it's fascinating. And for me, it was familiar because I had, you know, seen those other things. So I was enjoying it. I read the audiobook as kind of like a long podcast, sort of reviewing things. I did learn some things I didn't know before. For example, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, the prophet, I don't know what they would call him. Apparently, like, one of the biggest things he's known for is his insistence on polygamy, right? Apparently, for a long time, his followers didn't even know he was a polygamist. That came out later, that he had kind of tried to hide that, and really he was kind of a philanderer and just married women, you know. But my understanding was like that every Mormon person knew that and was like, no, this is the right way it should be, but apparently not.
Yeah, they deal with that a lot in the book. I, for context, pages, I read this book, I think a little over a year ago. So it's relatively fresh, but
yeah. No, but it's interesting. It also, like, again, points out that, you know, this is a real man. Like, this is his real history. But, you know, for people who follow the religion, he's, you know, their prophet, their saint, their whatever. So like, sort of humanizing him in some ways is criticism to them, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and there's lots of talks about Brigham Young, about, it is kind of absurdly funny that they just keep trying to move out of the United States because they're having problems with the government. And then the United States just keeps expanding west. And they're like, well, okay, I guess we're just part of you guys now, which I think is kind of darkly funny. So anyway, so I enjoyed all of that. The true crime story was also very interesting. I can see how it can't make an entire book because there isn't so much investigation. I can see how the context is needed to fill out the book. They do feel like two separate things. And I do really like John Krakauer as a writer. I think this was really well researched. He has great interviews. His writing style is, I guess I would say breezy, but it's well written. And he also like injects himself sometimes, like it's a narrative nonfiction. He'll talk a little bit about his background, his experience of religion, which I think I like it when you acknowledge that there's a person writing the book. It's not like a camera on the wall. Like, everybody has a perspective, and he has a perspective when he's writing this. So I enjoyed that. It's not as action dynamic as Into Thin Air, because they're not trying to survive on Mount Everest.
I almost didn't die writing this book.
Into the Wild has an element of like trying to figure out what happened to Chris McCandless. This doesn't have that, but I enjoyed it, and I like John Krakauer. I think overall, I was going back and forth between 3 and 4 stars. And I was telling Andrew about this. Like, I guess this would be a 4-star book, but to me, it's 3-star, which 3-star is not a bad rating for me. 3-star is like solid, good. If I hadn't had the context and I was learning all this for the first time, I think it would definitely be 4-star. But for me, it was kind of like reviewing. Okay, 3-star.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you thought of it? Because you must have read it before Book of Mormon and
I remember this being a huge thing on like learning what Mormonism was. I remember being bait and switched on this because I read Into Thin Air like in middle school, so I like loved like it's like, oh yeah, this is going to be an exciting like true crime story. It is not a true crime story. Like
it's not really what it
and
is. Yeah,
I remember having to tell people about this for a very long time of like, it's a good book, but it's more a textbook about Mormonism than it is a true crime story solving the murder. If you know that going in, then it really probably will change how you read it versus like, because I was disappointed where it's like, wait, we already know who did this.
Right.
It's not like...
And I did know it going in, and I think that's why I was like, yeah, this is what I signed up for. Feeling. Yeah. Andrew, what did you think of the book when you read
it? I think
it?
I was maybe a little more positive than you. I think even though I had some of the background you're talking about, I'd never had it laid out quite as clearly with as much detail.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it hit like a, you mentioned it felt like a long podcast. It hit like a very good note for me where I was like, this is informative and interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I probably would have given it 4, not 5, because I don't like think about it often at this point, but maybe around 4.
Nice.
If I was Mormon too, I would be kind of upset though if this is how people are introduced to Mormonism, because he does do a good job kind of splitting the difference. Like, this is what the general LDS church believes. This is what this sect believes. This is what this sect of this sect believes. Mm-hmm. He has to like really narrow it down to what these brothers believed.
But he does say things like, but in every sect, no women are allowed to be.
Yeah. I remember a lot of yo-yoing there by the end where it's like, I had to like look up again, like, wait, so what do Mormons believe out of this?
Mm-hmm. I will say on that line, and I bet this is going to relate to your notes, the edition I read is, I don't know if it's the newest one, but a recent one, and there's an afterword, which is like the afterword to the Anchor edition, and it's literally like 25 pages where John Cracker's like, this is a letter I got, a review from a Mormon paper, and he includes the letter in its entirety, and then he goes point by point to be like, this is why this critique is wrong, and I respect that.
You respect the pettiness of that?
I respect the pettiness. Like, it's not necessary because I've just read his whole book, and I know, because he'll be like, he said I said this, and I did not say that, and it's like, okay. I respect that he included it.
For some reason, and we'll get to this in the facts, for some reason the past like 5 or so years, he's become very like defensive on the offensive now, where like if he sees somebody like not telling the truth or somebody like misrepresenting him, he'll like go after it. It's like, okay, you didn't have to, okay.
A little extreme, okay. But yeah, do you have any facts?
Krakauer facts. You guys obviously all remember the facts that we covered 3 years ago, correct?
Because yes.
There'll be a quiz on this.
Great, yeah. Yes.
That he was born in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Oh, heck yeah.
But he was raised in Corvallis, Oregon. This is where this gets confusing, and I think they mentioned this in the book.
Oh, right? I made these facts. I remember now.
Yeah, you were on the thing. I was listening to it. That's what I was saying.
I was like, this sounds very familiar.
Because he says that, and he was born in 1954. He is not Mormon per se, but he says he grew up around a lot of Mormons because that part of Oregon has...
I think his dad might have been religious to some extent, if I'm remembering the book that I just read.
And I was trying to like look up, like, is he Mormon? It says he grew up around Mormons, but he himself is not Mormon. But you know what is his religion? Climbing. Because if you don't forget, he started climbing at the age of 8, and he climbed Mount Rainier when he was 10.
Dang.
And apparently he held that record for a while, actually.
Of being the youngest person?
Yeah, of being the youngest person to climb Mount Rainier.
Of being the dopest 10-year-old.
His dad really wanted to go to Harvard Medical School, but he said, nah, I'm going to become a journalist. Well, apparently he was a fisherman, mountain guide person that like kind of just wrote journals and stuff. And then Outside Magazine kind of used him as the guide to a lot of these places. And then they moved him from being a guide to being a reporter.
Gotcha. And he's a good writer.
His mountain climbing stuff also sounds insane, because in 1992, his first book, Iger Dreams, is kind of like all his mountaineering adventures.
With Bob Iger?
Bob Iger's.
Good joke.
Because a lot of the stuff he does is like going out to certain mountains on parts that have not been climbed before and then trying to figure it out. Like blind climbing, which does not sound fun.
My nightmare.
And then he wrote Into the Wild, which I keep thinking we covered it on the podcast. No, Billie's just covered it a lot in her life.
I've just talked about it a lot.
Follows the story of Christopher McCandless, dies in a bus, spoiler alert. And then more importantly, we covered Into Thin Air. Check out the episode. We talk more about it, about the disastrous Everest climb that he was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out in 1987, was a huge smash hit. And I don't know if we talked about this, but they had that movie Everest come out about it,
mm-hmm.
where he was betrayed by Michael Kelly from House of Cards. But I'm bringing this up because Krakauer has kind of now gone back on that movie because he was part of the promotion for it. And now recently he's come back and is like, no, actually that movie misrepresented a lot of the stuff that happened. And he goes down a list of like, this is what's wrong with that movie.
So he seems to really like lists that refute
things.
In
the end credits, he comes on and is like, okay, this is what I object to in the movie you just saw.
Okay. Because a lot of it, he says like, one of the things he was complaining is like, people didn't say that. It's like, John Krakauer, it's a movie. Like, We know they didn't say that.
He said help when really you put him saying, ah.
So that brings us to 2003, Under the Banner of Heaven, which is actually his best-selling book.
Hmm.
Yeah, he basically apparently had to fight to write about this because he was given the opportunity to write anything, like action-adventure things. But then a lot of publishing houses he'd come up to, he actually talked his way out of a few deals to do this book because they did think he could do true crime.
Well, it is very much different from everything else he'd ever written. So I can imagine him coming into my office and I'd be like, there's no mountains in it?
There's no mountains.
They put a mountain on the cover, though.
Yeah. Can we always put a mountain on the cover and make it seem like we do it? Obviously, it came out to huge acclaim, and the LDS Church does not like this book.
Why?
Why is that enough?
Yeah, come on, why?
This is directly from the LDS, their press release. This book is not history, and Krakauer is not a historian. He is a storyteller who cuts corners to make the story sound good. That sounds like the worst insult you could give to John Krakauer. You're saying I cut corners?
He did not cut corners. Also, for those of you who don't know, LDS stands for Latter-day Saints, aka Mormons.
Basic thesis appears to be that people who are religious are irrational and that irrational people do strange things. And on top of that, he has spent so much time responding to literally every press response. So I was trying to find a quote about John Krakauer, like responding to the criticisms. There's essays and essays he's written.
Yeah.
Basically, this was one that he wrote specifically for that. The leaders of the modern LDS Church deemed the history of the religion to be sacred and have long endeavored to retain a tight propriety control over how that history is presented to the world. And also, this is important though, he does say he likes the show.
Interesting.
Hey, big get, Garfield.
Well, the big get is that he says that the show's about his book, but it kind of explores more different stuff about it. It's like Mormons coming to terms with it. Dustin Lance Black wrote the show. He's a famous screenwriter, but also a Mormon who wrote Big Love.
Oh, yeah. And Milk.
He then wrote, because he just loves controversy, he wrote When Men Win Glory, The Odyssey of Pat Tillman, in 2007.
Let's just say somebody doesn't know who Pat Tillman is.
Pat Tillman was an NFL player who signed up for the Army after 9/11 and then was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan.
And let's just say it took a while for the real story to come out about exactly what happened to him.
Gotcha.
And this is when he doesn't get, a lot of his books now don't get straight up like great reviews across the board, but what a lot of the books do acknowledge is that he does cover a lot of detail.
Yeah, he does his research.
I haven't read The One Man, One Core. I always wanted to, but a lot of the notes where it's like, it's beautiful, but also it goes into every detail of his life.
I don't cut corners. How dare you?
Then, for some reason, I've been trying to find out why specifically he has started the longest beef with this guy named Greg Mortensen. He is a very famous humanitarian, like a public speaker. He raises money for the Central Asia Institute, which builds schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Greg Mortensen made a book that turned into a movie called Three Cups of Tea.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why John Krakauer wrote Three Cups of Deceit.
Was that a whole book he wrote?
It's an ebook, but he wrote that and then contributed to a 60 Minutes takedown piece of him. And he's currently embroiled in this. I don't know enough about Three Cups of Tea in order to get into this.
I think that's okay. We just know that he's a spiteful man.
5 stars for pettiness.
He and him have been, up to 2020, have been fighting over this.
Love it.
For over 10 years. And then his most current book, which came out in 2015, and we don't know what he's working on currently. He says he's working on something.
I'm sure he is.
But he wrote a book called Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. It is controversial because he tries to do it very fact-based, and a lot of people, including the Missoula student body and a lot of survivors and organizations that work with it, say it's like, glad he wrote this book, glad it's beautifully done, but he doesn't really fully understand the picture.
Okay.
But keep in mind, while he's doing this still, Krakauer is still writing. He edits the Exploration Center of the Modern Library, and he has a new book out in 2019 called Classic Krakauer, Essays on Wilderness and Risk.
Classic.
Classic.
I mean, I hope that like that goes back to his old like mountain climbing days where it's like, can we write something fun and
I think
crazy?
The idea that it's been 9 years since his last new book means he's not working on something easy.
Do you think there can be a classic Alexievich?
Classic Svetlana. Oh boy.
Yeah, I do not envy you for having to pull those out. Thank you for covering the facts on this one.
Yeah, thank you.
Those are beefy.
And now, Dylan, we thought it'd be fun for you to do a game for us.
After you did all those facts.
Because otherwise it would just be Andrew asking me to do a game by myself.
I was going to do a game, but I actually need your guys' help.
Okay. Uh-oh.
Because you know how I was starting that new like BuzzFeed-esque website where we talk about like old things millennials like?
Yeah, Dylan
like,
Buzz?
I decided to give John Krakauer and Svetlana Alexievich like a break and like they could help me write some articles. Their articles are very dense and very confusing and very extreme. They only gave me the titles and like the logline of what they're about, and I don't know what Saturday morning cartoon they're referring to.
Okay. Oh, well, gosh. We can work together.
Yeah, we can figure this out. Is this a, so this is this a game where we compete against each other? Or is
because I only have enough, because this is, again, media, I can only have enough budget to hire one part-time
writer. Okay, so we're competing for the job.
Thank goodness. Okay, and I'm really excited.
And again, feel free to cut me off in the middle of this if you think you've got it before the other person.
So chaos.
Just like logistically, you're going to start reading a title and we're going to try to figure out which Saturday morning cartoon they're referring to, and we can guess as soon as we think we got it.
Yeah.
Do we buzz in or do we just yell the answer?
Ooh.
Can we say Gak? Can we say Gak?
Buzz it. Yes, you can say Gak.
Okay.
Gak.
Y'all remember Gak?
Okay. I call this one Depressing Leads. all right. So the first title is Porous Is He.
Got it. Gak. It's SpongeBob SquarePants.
Oh.
Absorbent and yellow and porous is he.
Can you give us the whole title so we can appreciate your work?
Porous Is He. It follows a minimum wage employee as he perfects his culinary skills for a capitalist system that doesn't care if he lives or dies.
It's true.
It's very true, Mr. Krabs.
I know SpongeBob SquarePants.
Blue Bloods, a collective retelling of the natural commune where every member sacrifices their identity and last name for the greater good.
Blue Bloods.
Gak? Hey, dude? Salute Your Shorts?
Nope.
No. Okay, wait.
They're cartoons. Shoot.
One's not a cartoon, but they most
this one is a cartoon.
Okay.
Blue Bloods. Can you read it again one more time to see if I can get it? Because Bailey guessed wrong.
Blue Bloods, a collective retelling of a nature commune where every member sacrifices their identity and last name for the greater good.
I don't have it.
Apparently, it's the Smurfs.
Oh.
Oh.
So I might go back that far, too.
No, it was a good clue. We just didn't get it.
No.
We weren't thinking outside the box, but I am still winning, to be
clear. Salute Your Shorts.
Emerge from the shadows. An environmental disaster forces a group of youths underground where they confront the failed justice.
Me, Gak.
Bailey.
Fraggle Rock.
That is not correct.
Oh.
Finish reading it. I think I
where they
have
confront
it.
The failed justice system of their city.
Oh, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That is correct.
Okay, Fraggle Rock, though.
How the Mighty Have Fallen. An extraterrestrial force beckons a cadre of high
Me,
school.
Me, Gak. Power Rangers.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's good. You worked quickly.
Well, let's do the whole title, though.
How the Mighty Have Fallen. An extraterrestrial force beckons a cadre of high schoolers to do a paramilitary battle against the Agents of Chaos.
Yeah, I got it.
You heard about that.
Yeah.
I hope you guys are fast on the trigger on this one. Like no one ever was. An obsessive young man sets out
Gak.
Bailey.
No one to catch them is my Pikachu. Pokemon.
That is correct.
Answer Pokemon.
An obsessive young man sets out on a quixotic journey to catalog and befriend every creature in the animal kingdom.
Great.
Which sounds like a John Krakauer book.
It does.
We're tied again now, Bailey. This is close.
You are tied.
How many more are there?
There are two more.
Uh-oh.
The animal voice cries out.
Gak, the wild thornberries.
That is correct. Wow. I was going to say, a father and mother.
I'm learning the key to this game is trying to get it in the first thing before the colon that you put in.
Yeah.
A father and mother uproot their family to film the world's wildlife as their daughter begins to spiritually communicate with documentary subjects.
Yeah, again. This...
Yeah.
Sounds like John Krakauer piece.
Yep.
And the last one, The Way You Shake and Shiver. Paranormal investigators.
Gak.
Oh, gosh.
Ghostbusters?
No.
Nope.
Scooby-Doo.
That is correct. Andrew wins.
Okay, wait, say the whole title.
The Way You Shake and Shiver. Paranormal investigators explore the true ghosts of the American Midwest, the phantom of small business.
Key there is Shake and Shiver is from the song. Is from the song.
A lot of these lines are from the song.
Yeah,
which
I got
actually
that.
Is like, wow, these all really work as titles. Andrew, you get the job.
Yes. Bailey, unemployment.
That was very good though, Dylan.
Yeah, it was a great
good
game.
Connection and good titles. Love it. All right, so Dylan, this is, you know, you're shining in this podcast. It's now time for you to choose books at random from our shelves. It's time for The Choosening.
The Choosening. I mean, I feel bad, though, that Andrew's had to read, so much bad stuff happening that passed. It's, just so much ugly stuff.
Yeah.
It's, the brutal.
God, what's going to happen here?
The bloody and the terrible and the splendid.
Oh, God.
And the vile. That's right. The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, number 54.
Oh, your buddy Eric Larson.
Oh, my dude. This is the best news I've gotten all day. This is great. You know, I really thought I needed a little time away from World War II.
Nah.
But because it's the Lars man, I needed time with World War II again. So I'm going to read a little bit about the Blitz. I'm very excited. Oh, speaking of, I should have said this in the intro. I recently got a Goodreads offer. David Gran and Eric Larson were hosting an intimate gathering in New York City, and I was out of town for it.
Is it just for dads?
It was just... You have to be wearing a sweater
only,
and you have
only.
To have glasses that clip behind your head.
You have to have a dad joke to get in the door.
Yeah. So, okay. That's very exciting. I'm a well-known Larson head, and this has been one of the ones that I've avoided reading because I was like, I have to wait for it to be chosen for the
nice.
Podcast.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. What about me?
Well, Bailey.
Yeah.
I mean, are you feeling nervous about this? Are you
no.
feeling a little unease?
Should I be?
A Should you be? You should probably listen to that. I mean, you should probably trust The Gift of Fear and Other Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence by Gavin DeBecker, number 38.
I think I told this before, but I got this out of a Little Free Library, which I think is very funny. Okay, well, I'm excited for this. Again, my understanding is it's nonfiction, sort of self-help, telling women, trust your instincts. Men are creepy. So we'll see. Okay, great. So that means in 2 weeks on the podcast, Toby has Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot, and I have The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker.
We're keeping our nonfiction streak going.
Thanks for listening to the To Read List. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email thetoreadlistpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Goodreads, Instagram, and the Storygraph at the To Read List Podcast.
And if you want to help us find new listeners, there's a couple different ways you can do that. One, if you want to leave a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice, that really helps us find it. Specifically, the reviews warm our hearts to see, and it's great to hear what you think about the podcast. And another way is if you could just find somebody, anybody, someone you're interviewing for your incredibly detailed nonfiction book you're writing, tell them about our podcast. Word of mouth is the best way that we find new listeners, and good luck on that book you're writing.
Dylan, I'm promoting you. Thanks to Andrew and Dylan for co-hosting the podcast with me, to Dylan for also sound recording, and to Miss Jillian Beth Durkee for composing our intro song. We miss you, Toby. See you in 2 weeks. Happy reading.
Books, 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 books. Books.